Thank you very much for coming today. It's a special honor for me to be here, so I'd like to thank Carol, I'd like to thank Danny, and I'd like to thank the Sigmund Freud Museum of London. I will feel remiss if I don't say this every time I come here. I wouldn't have been able to write Revolution in Mind without the Sigmund Freud Museum in London. I was given access to an array of papers, which were unreasonably limited to scholarly use in the United States here, and I would simply have not been able to write the book if not for the generosity and the research commitment of the Sigmund Freud Museum. So I'm very much indebted to this institution. Today I'd like to talk to you about the entity that Sigmund Freud, in good part, spent most of his life trying to understand, the mind. And to do that, as my title seems to imply, we're going to have to understand competing notions, soul and bodily machine, that perplex us when we think about the mind and have created trouble from the creation of the notion of the mind to this day. It's a long story, it's a complicated story, but I hope it's a fascinating one. And today, I'm going to give you a whirlwind tour. Each one of the slides I'm going to show you is like a little haiku for a chapter. It's very, very brief, so I'm sure that it will engender questions and concerns about what's left out. I hope we can talk about all that in our question and answer period. Let me tell you just in very briefly how I came to write this book, because I think that will help make sense of it. I had finished Revolution in Mind, and I was looking for a new project. I thought the idea of writing a history of psychoanalysis after 1945 to the present was too daunting and also too complicated in a number of ways, including my own commitments about those things that might make it more of a distorted history. And so I thought, well, I'll write about the other really problematic and controversial thing in my field, which is the origins of psychiatry. Origins of psychiatry since Foucault have been exceedingly controversial. And I thought, okay, well, this is what I'll focus on. I did a lot of research, and I found that I was bored to tears. I was terribly bored. I would look at this stuff, look at it, and I thought, well, it's because there's nothing new here. This has been said. The idea that Pinel and Cherugi and these people started psychiatry was a well-worn notion. But the other thing that dawned on me was that these people who were touted as great originators didn't seem so original to me. In fact, it seemed like they were people who employed concepts that were already in place, that they were employing a framework that was already in place. And I thought to myself, well, if we pull the lens back, maybe I'll understand something and get to something more exciting. And for me, the lens had to go back to if there is a notion of mental health and of mental illness, then there has to be a notion of the mind that's natural. And when did that start? And how did that start? And boy, hasn't that been a problem ever since. So that's how I got going with Soul Machine. Now, immediately upon coming to this recognition, I looked in the obvious places for a history of the notion of the Western mind. After all, it's a big, grandiose idea, you think to yourself. Of course, people have written about this. And you turn immediately to not psychiatry or not medicine, but philosophy. You turn to the history of philosophy, where, of course, there's a whole discipline of people who do studies of the mind, philosophers of the mind. And what you find with philosophers of the mind, and if any are here, excuse me for saying so, even the best ones, some I admire terribly, their way of working with the past is not the way a historian of ideas works with the past. They'll have, in the same paragraph, someone from the 4th century BC in conversation with someone from the 18th century in conversation with Wittgenstein. And to my mind, this was hard to imagine as sensible. It was very hard to imagine that really those people were talking about the same things. In fact, it reminded me of something that was created by one of the great supporters of the Freud Museum, and that is this. The View of Philosophy from Monty Python. Let's see, are we going? How do we activate this, Danny? I'm hitting enter. And it's the left one. Do we have audio? Maybe all of you know this. So forgive me.
We must surely start papers this afternoon. It certainly attracted the most attention among the brands of their team problems.
Team problems, okay.
spinning fighting final. The referee, Mr. Confucius, checks his stand.
They're off.
Meet your neighbor. I'm on the outside. Just going to sign there with him. There's Archimedes. Socrates, there he is, Socrates. Socrates is there, going through. There's a wall. Well, maybe there's a call, but there's certainly no lack of excitement here. As you can see, Nietzsche has just been booked for arguing with the referee.
It's all over. Mark Spence, they were offsides, if you notice. So you get my point, that there seemed to be something so pulled out of the fabric of history that, thank you so much, that I thought, well, this is something that I think is a big story that has got to be told in history. Why does it have to be told in history? Because my contention is that the history of the mind is far from something for just the history of medicine or psychiatry. It's far from something just for the history of philosophy, but that the mind is at once a political, philosophical, medical, and scientific object, and that one has to look at these different facets, because at the time that the mind was created, there were no segregated disciplines. These were often the same people thinking about the medical consequences, the philosophical, the theological, and the political, all at the same time. So you have to be able to encompass notions of the soul, notions of science, notions of medicine, and very importantly, the political context to truly tell of the origins of this idea that's been so critical to all of us. It's a period of time that I'm going to cover in this quick talk today and in the book at more length that, you know, has come under some fire lately. It is something that loosely can be called the Enlightenment. It's going to be from about 1650 to 1820 or so. And there are debates that I won't go into in terms of whether there are national enlightenments, etc. My work is going to move from a discussion that's international amongst very early pre-modern scholars to the British Enlightenment, which I agree with Roy Porter precedes the French Enlightenment, then the French Enlightenment, and then the German Counter-Enlightenment. So you'll see that that's the big arc of my story. Okay, when David painted this painting of Socrates, take a close look, and look at the people in the corner here. They're horrified. Why are they horrified? They're horrified because Socrates is arguing that he is about to drink the hemlock, but his soul is immortal. And, in fact, there are many philosophical sects that believe at the time the soul is not immortal, that it's material. But that having been said, by the time of the 13th century and Thomas Aquinas, there was a very consolidated notion in Western Christendom that incorporated the church fathers and classical sources, and that was the Thomist synthesis. Aquinas is credited with that, and it is widely, widely accepted. And what that says is that we have three souls, or one that's segregated into three parts. You can keep yourself up at night if you care to worrying about that, but that was the claim. And the three were a vegetative soul, an appetitive soul, and a rational soul. The first, the vegetative soul, segregated the living from the dead. Plants had it, animals had it, we have it. The second, the sensitive soul, segregated animals from plants. It was also something the humans had, and it was about desire. The third was the rational soul. Only humans had it. It accounted for higher cognitive functions. It accounted for reason, will, memory. Some people had different faculties that they put in there. Now, the important thing about this tripartite soul was the first two, the one in plants and animals, was mortal. It was material. It died when you died. But the third, the rational soul, from the Greeks, incorporated into Christianity, was the same as the church fathers. It was eternal. It was God's gift to mankind. And therefore, it could never grow ill, and it could never die. What did that mean? It meant your soul couldn't grow ill, and it couldn't die. It could be possessed, but it could not grow ill or die. Now, this whole model, which was triumphant for over four centuries, starts to break down at the end of the 16th century, and it starts to break down in a bunch of different ways that alarm this man, Marin Mersenne. And Marin Mersenne is a friar in Paris who is quite concerned that this whole system is going to break down. And it's all interconnected. That's why they called the soul the knot of the universe. It tied nature and man to God. And if that broke down, he worried for Christianity and the soul. And he came up with a strategy. It became a very powerful strategy. He adopted Galileo's mechanics for all of the universe. And he was quite confident that if you adopted mechanics as the model for nature, not some of the animisms that some of the Renaissance people had, but mechanics, that there was no way you could explain away the Christian soul that was the rational soul. So if you adopted mechanics for how the earth worked and how animals worked, you could preserve this thing that could not be mechanical because it built itself. It had active forces. It willed. It reasoned. No machine could do that, he thought. And so he was very, very influential in his embrace of mechanics and his very stern defense of Christianity on this new turf. Not the scholastic turf that was breaking down, but this more modern turf. Now, in his circle were a number of very famous people, Hobbes, Pascal, but let's just talk about these two. You'll know him, perhaps that's René Descartes. And you may not know him, that's his opponent and enemy along with Hobbes, Pierre Gassendi. Gassendi and Descartes were on the opposite sides of a great debate. And the great debate really came to a head when in 1641, Descartes publishes the Meditations. Well, I should read you the full title of the Meditations because it kind of makes the point. The title of the book is Meditations on the First Philosophy, in which the existence of God and the real distinction between the soul and the body of man are demonstrated. And this is where Descartes works out the notion that we have a cogito, I think, therefore I am. It's immaterial. The rest of the world is open to skepticism, materialism, and mechanics. It is essentially a marching out of Mersenne's project. This man, Gassendi, says absolutely not. Some of those higher cognitive functions occur in animals. Some of them have to be material, too. And they get into this very bitter dispute where they start using nicknames for each other, Mr. Spirit and Mr. Flesh. Gassendi wrote a 600-page rebuttal of Meditations, which is, you know, about this big. It's like 120 pages. So this was a bitter dispute. But Descartes becomes very, very influential. And why? Well, there are a bunch of influences on this notion that perhaps the whole world is mechanical except for inner life. One of them is the rise of automata, like this one. This is a zither playing automaton. Descartes himself saw these water-powered, trumpet-blaring statues, and that blew him away. So he was kind of convinced that it's possible to say that your animals, your friends, are machines. Right? So he says famously that animals are bête machine. It's a little worse in French than in English because it's the double entendre is stupid machine. But animal machines have no capacity for I think, therefore I am. And we can study them in pure mechanical terms, right? So this is Descartes' dualist synthesis. The problem for Descartes is going to come here, which is to say, Gassendi immediately says to him, okay, smarty, if in fact an immaterial cogito is the source of reason and will and intention, how does that intersect with a material body? Well, Descartes, who at this point was fed up with Gassendi, said, you know, an idiot can ask a question in 2 seconds that a genius couldn't answer for a century. That was his dismissal of that question. But he then became in correspondence with a Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia. I think, in fact, he was in love with her. And she was a melancholic who pressed him on this question. And he began to do more and more anatomical research. He had already done a great deal of anatomical research. And he came to the conclusion that that thing, H, the pineal gland, a unitary structure in the center of the brain, that maybe that was the seat of the soul. And that's where the cogito interacted with the brain, and he published this. Well, this didn't go well for him. Because, in fact, that man, Thomas Willis, who is probably the foremost brain expert in the world, he's the founder of neuroscience at Oxford at the same time, says that this is a ludicrous claim, that there are very primitive animals with huge pineal glands. There's no way. Spinoza says that he had made a mockery of himself, Descartes, by making this claim. So this was going to be a big problem for dualism. How was it going to interact with the material? Now, at the same time that Descartes is trying to rescue the rational soul for modernity, it's breaking down in a bunch of other areas. What are the areas? Well, the ancient world, the scholastic Aristotelian world, was breaking down in a number of kind of critical debates. Here we have the Great Plague in 1665, the Bills of Mortality, and what happens during that great disaster? The physicians flee London. The physicians of the soul flee London. And you see this plaintive plea from the writer of the Bills of Mortality saying, may we pray that in the future, when we are under such siege, that the physicians of our souls and the physicians of our body will not so forsake us. It was seen as another admission of failure, that they had no power over these illnesses, that they weren't powerful enough to do anything about the plague. The Galenic doctors were losing prestige. They were many of people thought of them as murderers and of people who were protecting their income, still bleeding. People were terrified of the doctors. Another thing that's starting to diminish in its impact is the belief in possession. The way the soul could be altered was not through illness, since it was mortal, but through inspiration, that was good. Possession, that was bad. And this is Joseph Glanvill's attempt to defend spirits and possession and witchcraft, because if you deny witches, you deny angels. If you deny spirit life for witches, you're denying, perhaps, the resurrection of the Lord. And that's what he says up there when he says the Sadducees triumphant. The Sadducees were an ancient Jewish sect who denied the resurrection of the dead and denied all spirit life. So he, a member of the Royal Society, a man of science, was fervent in the belief that this diminishing ideology had to be held onto. But nonetheless, he was fighting a losing battle. The number of prosecutions kept dropping. Doctors kept claiming that these people were delusional, not possessed. Other failures of the ancient world were happening at the same time. The notion of melancholy, which had a Galenic meaning with humors, et cetera, was starting to be seen as perhaps mechanical, perhaps due to other forces. That's Robert Burton's great summa, really, of classical views of melancholia. But the most important challenge, in a way, to the old world view of the soul came from enthusiasm. Religious zealots. Religious terrorists, we might say. And what was happening, especially in England, but in other Protestant lands, was the creation of sects. Sects that sound a lot like rock bands. The Diggers, the Levellers, the Quakers, the Shakers. These were the ranters. And this exceedingly lewd picture, which I dare not describe to you, if you can see it, you can see it, and if not, cover your eyes. This is what the ranters are supposed to believe. They believe God made everything, and therefore everything is allowed. They're called ranters by their enemies. This is probably a poster made by their enemies that says that they curse and they have orgies and they do unspeakable things to each other. Now, this challenge to the political and social order was great because these people had direct communion with God. Enthusiasts had no Catholic priestly caste to stop them and claim that they're deluded. They claim direct, I heard it from God, therefore I start my sect, and therefore the king's rule means nothing to me because I actually only respond to God. And this becomes a big, big challenge, right? At the same time, the Royal Society is being birthed, and increasingly, there is a sense that science is on the move. In the Royal Society, many of the people are deeply Christian. Robert Boyle would be the exemplar of that. He's a Christian virtuoso. He calls for scientists who also are adamant in the faith. And what's the red line? The red line is the rational soul. It's the soul. Everything else can be viewed scientifically, not that. A few people follow Gassendi, and most importantly, the one who follows Gassendi in Oxford is Thomas Willis. Thomas Willis, the father of neurology, brain anatomist, starts to say with Gassendi that there's some higher level functions of the soul that actually are brain-based. And he has a medical student, a very, very bright medical student in the crowd, taking explicit, detailed notes, and that is John Locke. John Locke is going to be a central figure in my story, and he is a Calvinist who comes to London in 1656, and writes his father and says, the town has gone mad. There are religious zealots on every corner. They claim to have heard it from God. There's nothing one can say to them. There's a great disorder that's coming our way. He goes back to Oxford and he takes his notes and he studies with Thomas Willis, where Thomas Willis tells him a couple of things that if you know anything about John Locke, you learned in high school were John Locke's thoughts. In fact, if you look at his medical notes, Thomas Willis told him, the mind is a tabula rasa, right? A blank slate. That's supposed to be his idea. He got it from Thomas Willis. He absorbed a lot of the thinking of Willis and then transformed into a political operative, as many of you know. And he had to be on the run a good deal and worked on this project. And the project he thought was one that would help secure the political order by limiting the claims of human understanding. This is his great essay concerning human understanding that gets published in December of 1689. He works on it for 30 years, and what does he say? He says, this synonym, mind and soul, because in Shakespeare it's a synonym, in Milton it's a synonym, mind is just another word for soul. Actually, these are two very different things. Yes, you have your soul for eternal life. Yes, you have your private belief in your soul. But that's not for the public square. There is this other thing that is quite material called a mind. And the mind has very significant limits on what it can know. It's made out of active thinking matter that's somehow in the brain. How is it in the brain? God made it so. Same thing Willis said. We don't know how. There's active thinking matter in the brain, and that's how the mind works. Yes, it's a tabula rasa. Yes, it works with associationalism. I see, I hear, I put together the same thoughts. And what does this mean about the kind of knowledge that the mind can have? It means that it's contingent, it's parochial, it's prejudicial, it's provisional. If you grow up here, you're going to have a whole bunch of associations that you think are the truth. And if you grow up here, you're going to have a whole bunch of associations that you think are the truth. And what does that mean for the political order? It means that you can't claim to have absolute truth. It means that you have to, in fact, embrace his political ideology of toleration. Political and religious toleration flow from a psychological innovation that Locke puts forward in this great book, where he coins this distinction between mind and soul, as well as consciousness and self. So consciousness, self, this fallible mind that is material and contingent, also leads to a notion that it can break down. What does he say about that? He says we're all a little crazy. We all have little misassociations. That's the minor misassociations of everyday life. And therefore, it makes sense that one should be able to do something about it. That one should be able, perhaps, to treat it. Now, doctors were exceedingly conservative. They had held on to Galenic humoral theory for, 1,500 years. So they really moved slowly. But eventually, by around 1750, there were a number of doctors who had taken up Locke's ideas. Locke had returned in 1689 with the Glorious Revolution. He was a hero. So there was a lot of credibility to what he said. And this is William Batty, the first, perhaps, of the English Lockean mind doctors, who claims in his 1758 book, Treatise on Madness, that madness can be biological, can be brain-based, but can also be ideational with these Lockean misassociations. And we can treat those with, you know, some people have reviewed my books and said something like CBT. It is a lot like a cognitive therapy. You correct the incorrect associations and you cure the delusion. It was a minor view, if an innovative, but still minor, until this man became mad, and that is, of course, King George. And when King George became mad in 1789, and the society doctors came in to treat him and proved to be exceedingly useless, worse than useless, say, you know, their treatments were often quite lethal, at some point, they bring in the ringer, this kind of outsider, Francis Willis, who has adopted Batty's ideas, Locke's ideas, ideas of mental treatment and behavioral treatment, and he is credited with curing the king. Now, whether he did cure the king or not is another question, which if you want to, we can talk about. But the point is, all around Europe, there is this astonishment that madness has been cured in England. Everyone knew the king was mad. It was a shocking thing that had spread throughout Europe. The king was supposed to be absolute ruler. He was supposed to be close to God. That he was mad was shocking. That he was cured was even more shocking. And so what happens is, across in France, there becomes this great fashion for Locke, Lockean doctors, and Lockean thought. It comes with the Anglophilia that really dominated France in the 1730s to 1770s, where Newton, Bacon, and Locke are seen as the progressives that are embraced by the avant-garde in France, despite living under absolute rule. And there are a bunch of people who start to take up Locke's ideas, but they have a certain problem. In fact, Locke's great essay is first published, not in English, but in French, in an abridged form. And the translator, God bless him, was in deep, deep trouble. Because the word mind, in fact, doesn't really exist in France. It doesn't really exist to this day in French. And he struggled with what to do. His choices were esprit and âme, spirit and soul. And he struggled because obviously both of those didn't mean what Locke meant. He had worse trouble with consciousness, which he translated as conscience, which means conscience. And he put a footnote and said, this isn't really what he means, but this is the best I can do. Anyway, it was a terrible problem. But then maybe it wasn't a terrible problem. Because for these people who are starting to write about the mind as not a synonym of the soul, but as a material object, the censor was right around the corner. This was, of course, scandalous to do. So plausible deniability wasn't a bad thing to have. And this man, Claude-Adrien Helvétius, when he writes his great book on the mind, it's called De l'Esprit. He writes it anonymously. His name is not on it. He nonetheless gets run out of Paris. Everyone knows who wrote it, and everyone knew what it was about. But he had a little bit of deniability. These people were sensationalists. They got rid of Locke's active power of reflection, and they started to expand these mentalist views in France. What they didn't have, really, was any way of embodying the mind. They were not clear about how that worked or even had a notion about it. But soon these people would. These people are frequently left out of the history of science. They're left out of the history of psychology. Why? Because they were bad scientists. They had the wrong answer. This is one of the lessons that I think I learned while writing this book, is that presentist notions of right and wrong can really destroy the fabric of history. And so these people actually were critically important. They're called the Montpellier Vitalists. And they had this notion, taken from an experiment that Albrecht von Haeler did. Albrecht von Haeler, Swiss, very pious man, determined that muscles were irritable. If you touched a muscle fiber, it contracted. And nerves, he claimed, were sensible. That they had a sensibility. and that therefore they had an active force. Well, this was assumed to be correct. And if it was correct, what did it mean? It meant that there was active forces in the nervous system that, if they grew complexly, could be active minds. And therefore, the mind-body problem disappeared. The embodied mind could be part of a vitalist body that was tingling with irritability and sensibility and had active powers within it. These people became very famous in France at the time. This man, you'll remember if you've read D'Alembert's Dream, because he was very close to Diderot. This is from the Encyclopedia, where about 50% of the medical entries are written by Montpellier vitalists. And these people, you can say, well, big deal. Who cares? Well, I think, and I make the claim in this book, that they create a foundation for people to think about what's natural. Natural law was so important. We're not going to use theological ethics. We need to think about what's natural. And who's the person who does that more than anyone? Probably the most influential person of the second half of the 18th century, and that's Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau is deeply interested in the vitalist, interested in the morals of sensibility, he calls it. And what does he do? He rewrites our notion of childhood. You see here what he says. He says, here are the rules of nature. Why do you contradict them? Right? He's talking about parents and children. Changes our notion of childhood, changes our notion of romantic love, changes our notion of ethics, and changes our notion of the social contract. And much of his thinking, I argue, is undergirded by this notion of sensibility that comes from nervous and mental sensibility. Now, the same model of sensibility leads to a model of how sensibility can go wrong and how you could be mentally ill. And Pinel comes very much from the Montpellier School. He's considered the founder of psychiatry, although he called it mental medicine. Cabinet started his human science. These were people who, after 1789, said no souls at all, mind and brain. The church was now no longer a worry after 1789 in France. So they went full force with a notion of mind medicine and a kind of anthropology based on what Cabinet called human science. He wanted to do an anthropology that was mentalist and it integrated mind and body and would inform legislatures. He wanted it to be a political force. Now, they were not unchallenged, and one of the great challenges came from an even more radical force, and that is Franz Anton Mesmer. These people believed not in a soul, but in a mind-brain unity, mind-body unity. But here comes from Vienna, Franz Anton Mesmer, and he says, no, there's no, the behavior and inner experience is not, doesn't have anything to do with souls. It doesn't have anything to do with minds and ideas. It has to do with magnetic forces, right? So I call him an astrophysical reductionist. He's really, in a way, the first eliminative reductionist. You know, we have those in philosophy, people who say there's no such thing as mind and we're all neuronal energies. And that's what he said. And he tried to prove it with his different experiments. He was lampooned almost immediately. And finally, the king, in 1784, said we have to have a commission look into this because it had become a fad in Paris. And the famous Franklin Commission, because it was run by Benjamin Franklin, concludes three things. One, it's partially fraudulent. Two, it's based on persuasion. And three, imagination. So they thought that was the end of it. Except some people thought closely about that, and they said, okay, fraud, that's not very interesting. But can persuasion and imagination make people do stuff like that? And if that's true, we better look into persuasion and imagination. Those are powerful forces. So that's going to engender a number of mentalist movements, including the branch of mesmerism that becomes hypnotism, with unconscious ideas. Let us move to our final chapter now, and that becomes the German critique of the mind. German was a language that was not spoken by much of Europe. It was more isolated. It was many principalities and quite divided. But this woman, Germaine de Staël, Swiss, brilliant, well-connected. Her father was very powerful. Hears about this cool stuff that's happening in German-speaking lands. And she becomes the French expositor to the world, and then in English, of this really powerful critique of what's happened in the English Enlightenment and the French Enlightenment with regard to mind. And she focuses quite rightly on this man, Immanuel Kant. Now, I will not speak long about Immanuel Kant for fear that I will lose many of you. But I will say that in 1781, when he wrote the Critique of Pure Reason, it was an attempt to critique both empiricism and rationalism. And one of the things he said was, this empirical model that Locke had of, like, the stuff comes into the blank slate and we just associate it together, that doesn't really make sense. There are these transcendental a priori's, transcendental, metaphysical a priori's, by which we structure experience, and they're space, time, and causality. Space, time, and causality structure our experience, so there's active structuring forces that he calls metaphysical. And what happens almost immediately is Kant loses control of his own ideas. So Karl Reinhold, who becomes his primary expositor, says, this guy's a genius, I'm on his team. He says that there are conscious ideas and these kind of not-so-conscious ideas that mold them. Kant didn't say that. He wasn't a psychologist. He thought they were metaphysical. But Reinhold, and for a while the theory was called the Kant-Reinhold theory, believe it or not, changed this to a psychological model, a mentalist model, where there was unconscious structures that were giving form to conscious experience. And this gives rise to a number of philosophical movements, subjective idealism with Johann Fichte, and Schelling, and the emergence of nature philosophy, in which this post-Kantian idealism engenders notion of an active structuring mind that doesn't just take in reality, but creates reality. That in the extreme, life is a dream. And it engenders a great deal of romantic aesthetics, politics, and medicine. This is Caspar David Friedrich, Two Men Contemplating the Moon, and you see the notion is the whole world is alive with inner forces that radiate, including the mind. Nature philosophy and this movement, Schelling especially, give rise to Johann Ryle, who coins the word psychiatry and is appropriately considered the founder of psychiatry. And what he says is, there's a way that the mind is embodied. It's an emergent structure. First you have anatomy, then you have physiology, and then you have this thing he called psychiatry. None of them are reducible to the other. Physiology is not reducible to anatomy. It's an emergent structure. Psychiatry is not reducible to physiology. It's an emergent structure. All of these levels have causal power. We think that's a new idea, emergent structures. It's not. It's in Johann Ryle. And he thinks that there's a self, an overriding self, that psychiatrists need to focus on. It doesn't mean that anatomically you can't be sick. It doesn't mean that physiologically you can't be sick. But it does mean that if your self fragments, you can be mentally ill. So he has this complex model of the three levels, each with their own pathologies, none reducible to the other. And self-fragmentation, for those Cahusians out there, there's one of your founding fathers. Finally, let's say a word about the resolution of all these problems. There were so many problems with the mind, right? And what happened was Franz Josef Gall resolved them all. Or so it seemed. So it seemed. Here's Lavater's physiognomy. Physiognomy was a discredited field that said basically you can read character on one's face. And Lavater published books with pictures like this, marginal, not really well respected. But a philosopher, a good friend of Goethe's named Herder, looked at this stuff and did a lot of dissection and said, you know, the thing that I notice is you can't really read character on someone's face. But have you ever noticed that when you dissect snakes, that their brains follow the cranium? And that if you dissect a coyote, the brain follows the cranium? And that if you dissect a bird, what if the cranium actually reflects the brain in humans? That's Herder. Well, Franz Josef Gall takes off with this. And he comes up with a solution to the mind-brain problem, to the problem of how diagnosis can be related to pathology, and how diagnosis can even be related to character. And he resolved the question of how a mind science could be empirical, because so many were so disturbed that inner experience was not empirically accessible. Well, no problem, because it's actually all on your skull. And here are the 27 regions of the brain, each one with a mental character, avarice, lust, theatricality, etc., the 27 of them, each with their one spot, so it's brain localization, that if you very carefully palpate the skull, you can see who's got an extended one, oh, pathology, or, hypertrophic one, pathology. So he did all these calipers, very close readings of the skull, to find the mind that was connected to the brain, that made diagnoses, that told you about someone's character, that solved the problems of the mind. And of course, the big problem was none of this was so. So, Franz Josef Gall puts this forward, and the fact that none of it is so does not deter 16 out of 21 asylum directors in your own country here, England. It is very popular in the United States because the doctors love it. It tells everyone we're scientific, we've got it worked out, we've got the mind connected to the brain, we've got our version of the CAT scan, we can find it immediately, it all works. Until, of course, it is mocked and ridiculed and mocked and challenged. And that takes 30 or 40 years, but it does eventually collapse. And with it, when it collapses, so too does mentalism, or the first wave of mentalism. The first wave of mentalism, I would argue, runs from about 1650 to the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. And then it starts to diminish as there is political reaction, the return of the church, and the return of more conservative political structures. What happens after 1815? Well, in France you have Comte saying science is positivism and there can be no psychology that's a science because it's based on inner report. That's not scientific. In Vienna and in German lands you have biophysics, where a number of people like Helmholtz and some of Freud's teachers say there's no such thing as mind causes. All of that can be reduced to physics and chemistry. And you have these compromise formations like Victor Cousin, who says, yeah, the mind is still there, but it's all rooted in the soul. He becomes super important in France. Every child reads Victor Cousin in their textbook for the next 30 years. And so the first wave of mentalism dies down. And it recommences around 1870, recommences in a way that is somewhat different. How is it different? Disciplines emerge, and what they do is they purify themselves of this problem. Wilhelm Wundt says about psychology, which starts to get going again with trying to figure out how the mind and the brain interact, how the mind and the body interact. Forget how they interact, he says to his colleagues. We're just going to study mind causes as they relate to each other. We don't know how to manage interactionism. Same thing for neurology. John Hewlings Jackson says, yes, they run in parallel. We have no idea how mind causes and brain causes connect, though. So we as neurologists will just study the brain and brain causes. And for psychoanalysis, of course, Freud abandons the 1895 project, and he adopts psychic determinism, but is agnostic about the mind-brain. There, you know, these quotes where he says, we don't know, it's like a black box how the brain is impacting the psychic determinism. And finally, there is this one last field that never really quite purifies itself, and that's psychiatry. Psychiatry remains unstable, a hybrid field that is very prone to periods of swinging to more neurology or psychology, but never successfully purifying itself of either. Finally, let me just read to you the last paragraph of my book, because it sums up this last point, series of points. A vast attempt at synthesis had failed and left behind modern men and women who now must navigate between competing notions of their own being. Western believers and the spiritual heirs of Romanticism, never vanquished by modern secularism, continue to look to their souls for hope, meaning, and salvation. When the room spins or spots darken our vision, however, whether religious or not, we become exquisitely aware of the complex worrying mechanisms within our astonishing physiology and anatomy. Mostly, though, we pass through our waking hours secure in the distinctly modern belief that we possess the power to think, choose, sympathize, create, love, learn, wish, and remember, thanks to a domain once known as the rational soul, but now called the mind. Within its invisible labyrinth, we exist, creators and inhabitants of our inner worlds, modern hybrids of soul and machine. Thank you very much.
Checking the time. I think we have a good half hour for questions. Please.
Spinoza.
I was reading some commentary on the ethics, and it seemed to address all that you said when you talked about the spiritual and brings together, and was so prescient with all that followed. I didn't get a chance to check your index, but you do speak of them. You spoke of them once tonight, but I was just wondering where you place it.
So placing Spinoza is actually a very difficult thing to do. Why? Because it was very dangerous to cite Spinoza. So that people read him secretly, but I think contemporary notion of Spinoza's place in this history is inflated in part because we love Spinoza so much. We think Spinoza anticipates so much. But one of the things that I tried to manage were things like, you know, David Hume is in many ways a much more refined philosopher than John Locke. You read him and you think, this is wonderful stuff. But as he himself said, his book fell into nothingness. And so if you're doing the history of ideas, you really have to try to be careful to not use your contemporary impressions of what's powerful and really search out, are people citing this person? Are they following this person? And one of the things that you find, frankly, it's kind of interesting, is that Hobbes and Spinoza, who were the two most radical thinkers of the time, in a way, were both considered radioactive. They were both only read secretly, almost never referred to publicly, except for as heathens, demons, and in all sorts of negative terms. So I'm very interested in Spinoza. I think Spinoza does anticipate some of this, but it's very hard to see his impact because of those factors. And I do write about him, and I do try to at least lay out the ethics and lay out the place of the ethics in these debates, but it's true that I don't give him a huge place.
Thank you.
I have to come back to Spinoza. Did Freud not agree with him regarding determinism? Spinoza said that there is a master, an inner master in us that determines our inclination?
Well, you know, look, I think that Spinoza Spinoza's a pretty weird thinker. I mean, that animus, that model that he has, I don't think Freud would have fully accepted it, but he did look to Spinoza sometimes. You know, Spinoza was an animist. He believed that, you know, that molecules had minds. And so I think that there's a mystical part of Spinoza that we should not neglect, and I think it would have been difficult for Freud to actually fully adopt it. So I don't actually see that.
Other questions?
Just
else who I thought you might actually be talking about was Dolbach and his man-machine, because in a sense, picking up the sensationalists in France, I was just wondering whether Dolbach deserved a place there after all. He was extremely well-known, even if much hated. He went through umpteen editions, and he's making some of the points which I think you'd carry on from Locke.
This is Delbos.
La Mettrie.
No. Yeah. You mean La Mettrie? La Mettrie. Oh, La Mettrie. Okay, Delbos is a 19th century thinker, though, so that's beyond, this book ends around 1840. Right, but La Mettrie is...
The gentleman refers to La Mettrie.
Yeah, okay. So the title of the book is really supposed to alert you to two points in history. I mentioned one, the Bête machine, the animal machine, and then, as you say, middle of the 18th century, 1752, I want to say, Julien de La Mettrie takes this further, and he says, actually, humans are machines. And the homme machine, man machine, is his claim. So yes, I write extensively about that, and it's a quite fascinating thing because again, it is so scandalous that you have to really search to see who is picking up on it. But interestingly, people like Tissot years later go, "That guy was telling the truth." So there are interesting ways that was followed through on. He, you know, one of the great debates among La Mettrie scholars to this day is when you say homme machine, did he mean to mechanize man or to give something different to the machine? And when you read the book, actually, not just the title, people like just read the title and that's it, man machine, obviously refers to like animal machine, means we are fully mechanical. You read the book, he was very interested in the Montpellier Vitalists. He was interested. He dedicated the book to Albrecht von Haller. I call this a Judas's kiss because Albrecht von Haller wanted nothing to do with La Mettrie. Scandalous guy. He dedicates his book to Haller, who does the nervous sensibility stuff. And when you read it closely, you kind of wonder, are there times where he's saying that actually it's not reducing man to machine, but the opposite of, in some way, putting the spirit in the machine, if you will. It stops around 1840. It's about 1650 to 1840.
I just happened to have that sentence before your last paragraph. I was reading your book today, and I was struck by that you seemed to come up to the contemporary time.
Oh, well, in my last chapter, I try to say a little bit about what's going to happen. You know, the same way this last slide shoots you forward into really, for me, what was, you know, my other book, which is. The kind of struggles with the second wave of mentalism. So I, as markers in very few words, say a little bit about that, but that's not what this book is fully about.
But your point in that penultimate paragraph is that today there is no rapprochement, there's
exactly.
No synthesis between
I agree.
Humanists and scientists, but I wonder.
Yeah, well, you know, my conclusion is that there are these three competing essences that have to do with the soul, the brain seen as a mechanical object, and the mind seen as a object that has causal force and will. And I would argue that those things are very powerful forces in our culture, in Western culture, and are unintegrated, so that one can potentially seem to be in contradiction with the other, and at times imperially try to destroy the other, if you will, and yet they all seem to exist. So that would be that is part of my conclusion. Yes.
Just in that context, what's your view on neuroscience?
Right. So I am a big fan of good neuroscience and a big enemy of bad neuroscience. And what I mean by that is I am in the Department of Psychiatry, and I'm very committed to neuroscience doing what it can do. But what I worry about is the extension of this for political purposes in the same way we saw with Gaul. Scientism is a very powerful force in the neurosciences where people want to make exaggerated claims for what they found out with their mice and their mice models. So I'm very concerned about that. I think it's a powerful force. I think that artificial intelligence is going to be a very powerful force that's going to make claims that we are machines, and with those huge amounts of money coming from Silicon Valley, and there's going to be better and better AI programs that are going to really threaten the notion that we aren't machines. And so I'm very concerned about that, too. I see that as a great challenge for the future.
Maybe I can come in here.
Sure.
I mean, one of the things I appreciated so much in your book is that the story you tell is not a story of steady progress. It's a story of conflict, of fits and starts, and as such, I think you've really managed to capture the various antinomies and disparities and antagonisms that exist over a period of roughly 200 years. Because all too often one comes across these so-called Whiggish histories that are purely focused on showing how over time not only do we accumulate more knowledge, but better knowledge, and arrive at better conclusions. And I think your story shows how that is actually not the case. And to come to this slide here, which in a sense is an addendum to your book,
right.
It does finish during the early 19th century,
right.
You also show how we still haven't succeeded in closing the gap, if
right.
that's the right word, between the mind and the brain. And you yourself don't seem to be too optimistic that it will ever be closed. Which leaves me with the question, that's definitely what psychologists would probably argue in my department. Why do we need the mind? Why do we still need it?
Yeah.
So I'm not even sure whether that is still an alternative there,
yeah.
neurology or psychology, because most of the psychologists I know are cognitive neuroscientists. Not
right.
even closet. They're
yeah.
quite open about it.
Yeah.
So I guess the question I want to ask you is, what do you think is the future of the mind, given that so much within psychology, neurology, psychiatry, and associated disciplines is now focused on the brain?
Yeah. No, it's a great series of questions, so let me try to answer them in order. I think that it's fair to say that I certainly don't have a Whiggish view that we start off in ignorance and we move towards light. That having been said, I think there are movements towards light, and I do think that they're not ones that I underline from a kind of 21st century point of view, but ones that you see as you see the story emerging. In other words, you see the power and the value and the function of some of these ideas, and how they allow for different possibilities that have to be thought of as, in some way, improvements. So we could argue about which ones those were, but I would argue that that leads to your last question, why do we need the mind? Look, I was asked this on a radio show, and the person said, well, then there would be no psychology, and there would be no psychoanalysis. And I said to him, that would be the least of our problems. What would happen to secularism? What would happen to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness if there is no mind that can pursue happiness? If there is no will or intention, what happens to our notions of who we are? Right? There is, on this weird, unstable island of the mind, something huge that grew. It was liberal, secular culture. And it has a great deal that would be compromised if, in fact, Daniel Dennett or the neuroreductionists had their way and said, actually, all that stuff you think is a little film that's delusional and has nothing to do with any causal structure. You have no intention. You have no will. So that's why we need the mind. The mind, if you see in this book, becomes this incredibly generative idea. It's true that it's a shapeshifter, and it's so complicated that the Scottish spin it this way. They're really interested in sympathy and relationships, and Locke spins it about ideas, and it's more rational, and the Germans think of it as the subject creating, and the French have a lot about the passion. So everyone has different facets of this complex beast. But they're all, I think, really part of the same story of trying to understand inner life in a rational way that is natural and not supernatural. And all of that, I would argue, from the big picture, from the 50,000 foot view, was surely progress. Now, I'm arguing against people who say it's not, right? So Foucault and the post-Holocaust, post-modernist theoreticians look at the Enlightenment and they say, this was actually a disaster. And I would say to them, look at what the Enlightenment replaced before you're so quick to judgment, right? So I would say that that's why we need the mind, and the fact that the mind-brain gap is not closed, I don't think it means it's never going to be closed. I just think we have to be clear about the questions that you have to answer to close that. Because I'm going to be on a panel back in New York next week that's called My Neurons Myself. And I think for my own personal safety, I'm going to be videoed. And because everyone else there believes that because they've studied neurons, they can say a lot about selves.
Absolutely.
Now, I think that means they don't even understand the questions. So if there's one thing I would say this book does, it alerts us to the questions. And if you haven't answered those questions, please don't say you've solved the mind-brain problem.
Thank you. There's one more question I want to ask before I open it up again. I mean, you've written a 600-page book on psychoanalysis, so I'm not sure the question is fair. But I think Freud only gets one or two mentions in this particular book.
Correct.
And that's obviously partly to do with the fact that, or mainly to do with the fact that your story ends during the early 19th century, so prior to Freud was even born. But nonetheless, I would like to ask you the question.
Sure.
Freud himself, pretty much throughout his works, continues to use the word Seele,
mm-hmm.
soul.
Yep.
I mean, there were alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And when he uses it, I never get the impression that he's thinking about it in religious terms, let alone spiritual terms like the ancient Greeks would have done
mm-hmm.
when they used either pneuma or psyche. So maybe the real question is that when you use a word, be it soul or mind, I'm not convinced that it is intrinsically associated with a certain paradigm, because you also seem to argue that we need the mind in order to have a secular conception of subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that using a particular concept, by definition, implies that paradigm, much like for Freud, Seele did not intrinsically imply.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, thank you for that question. And in the same way that in France, esprit and âme were the two alternatives, and people struggled with how to refer to the natural mind. In German, Geist and Seele were the two options. There wasn't, unlike Spanish, unlike Italian, there wasn't a direct translation of the Latin mentis. And so, in fact, you're right, that these words continue to this day. If you write a book called Revolution in Mind and you have a German translation, the word that they use for mind is Seele. So you know, I think that it allows for a lot of semantic slippage, but I think that it doesn't mean that the notion of that the concept of a natural mind is any less critical and any less powerful for a culture. So, the part of my book that's about German-speaking lands very much struggles with, how these people try to refer to Locke, how they try to refer to embodied minds, and how they develop their own tradition, right? So the semantic slippage occurs, and the German Romantics have a Seele, and it's not the Church Fathers' Seele. So is Freud referring to Schopenhauer, or is he referring to the Pietists? Or you have to kind of really be careful about what Freud's referring to. And my argument is, if you're really careful about what Freud's referring to, you'll know something about his discursive community and the way they use that term. So I think that, in that way, you can understand the conceptual underbearings of a particular term.
Well, conceptually, maybe it was also his way of distancing himself from German idealist philosophy, because Hegel uses Geist rather than Seele,
and so do others.
I mean, it's an interesting. It would be an interesting study to look at those.
Yeah.
Any other questions from?
I can't help but just ask. In your English-speaking practice and in your discursive community, do you use the word soul?
No.
I have colleagues who and patients who say, "Yes, you described I had a sickness of the soul. I lost my soul."
Mm-hmm.
And the word seems to be in coinage.
Well, that's what my point that I made earlier, that these traditions continue side by side. They're difficult to integrate, but that's right, that people refer to their souls all the time. They might mean it when they're feeling moved by a loved one. They might mean it when they're in church. They might mean it when they're dancing to James Brown.
It's very culturally dependent. Last year we had someone come here to talk about some work he had done in Japan in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. And they tend to refer to the heart,
yeah.
You see, as you probably
In fact,
know,
their word for the mind is the heart.
Yeah, kokoro.
Exactly.
I mean, there's another interesting study to be done there about how different cultures and different traditions within one particular culture use certain terms as the seat and the source and the origin of called mental conflict. Right? Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Just a footnote to your question. I mean, before Freud, Flechsig, who was the master of German psychiatry. He was using the term organ der Seele. Brain was the organ der Seele.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this occurs in Freud once or twice. The seeing organ. The brain is the organ of the soul.
Well, so he was very much a brain psychiatrist.
But surely he didn't mean anything supernatural, right? No, these were the words that you would use for mental function.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Any other questions? If not, we can close it here. Just a few words. So as I said before the lecture, some people came late. George has very kindly agreed to sign books downstairs in the bookshop. So if you've already purchased your book or you want to purchase a book, we do have some copies available. Please make your way downstairs and George will sign them. Secondly, we have some flyers here containing all the information about our 30th anniversary program and fundraising campaign. Please take one with you and have a look at what we have on offer. It's very exciting, and I hope you'll decide to support us. And finally, I think the only thing I can do is thank you for a fascinating whirlwind tour and an even more fascinating book.
So, thank you so much. Thank you.